abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, March 11th, 2014. What an insane week it is around here in the Woods world. I hosted the Peter Schiff Show twice this week, today and yesterday. And I love doing that, but it takes up the whole morning and means I can't be working on recording homeschool videos for the Ron Paul homeschool program. And I have got over 600 videos that I'm recording. I've done about a third of them up to now. A little over 600 need to be done. I'm recording videos in history, economics, etc. in the high school grades. It's a K through 12 curriculum, but I'm doing high school grade courses. And it takes forever if you want to do a good job. And I do want to do a good job. I'm doing the best I can. And of course, it's sucking all the life out of me. I am absolutely exhausted working and working and working. It's very rewarding, not financially, of course, but very rewarding to know that I'm doing something that I hope will be of lasting value. But I will tell you, it is absolutely killing me. So two shift shows this week. I'm trying to do 10 to 15 videos this week. Then on top of that, I got an event to get ready for this Saturday at the University of Central Arkansas. I've got the podcast. Of course, I love doing that. Then I've got the script has just been sent to me for the Bubble documentary. I got to go through that and consult on that. I still have some work to do on that ebook that I'm trying to get for you guys, that free ebook of the transcripts of the shows from 2013. So it's totally insane. Totally insane. So if the programs this week aren't any good, you know, I'm doing my best. I can't even tell anymore if it's a good show or it isn't. So I'm doing my best here. So enough of my griping. Let's bring Marshall DeRosa on. We'll both gripe about the state of things. Marshall DeRosa is a professor of political science at Florida Atlantic University, where he's been since 1990. He's also a Salvatore Fellow with the Heritage Foundation. His teaching specializations are American constitutional law and policymaking, international law, law and American society, and the judicial process. He's the author of numerous books, among them The Confederate Constitution of 1861, an inquiry into American constitutionalism, published by the University of Missouri Press, and The Ninth Amendment and the Politics of Creative Jurisprudence. It's my pleasure right now to welcome Marshall DeRosa. Marshall, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate the opportunity.
I can't remember the last time we spoke. I think we were maybe at the Mises Institute together years ago? It seems like it's been quite some time. It's been too long. But you're down there in Florida, Florida Atlantic University. You've been keeping an eye on 10th Amendment stuff that's been going on. You've been friendly with the 10th Amendment Center of Florida and doing some 10th Amendment activity in South Carolina. And that's all wonderful. I know that you are a little bit more pessimistic about the ultimate outcomes of some of these efforts maybe than I might be. But as we were chatting before we went on the air, I asked you, what do you think the ultimate sort of solution is? And I was sort of directing you in the avenue of secession, just to feel you out on how you felt about that. And I think you thought I was afraid that that would be too radical for my show. But never fear, right? Nothing's too radical for this show. So let's talk a little bit about secession. The idea of secession, of course, is absolutely toxic in the minds of so many Americans. What do you think it would take to get that to change?
What would it take to get that change? Well, several things. First of all, America's going to have to be educated on the nature of the Union as originally intended, because secession was part and parcel of the original agreement between the states. And as you know, several states ratified the U.S. Constitution with the proviso that its things didn't work out, they could rescind the ratification, become independent once again. But Americans have been indoctrinated, especially since the New Deal. This is a relatively recent phenomenon that parallels the growth of the national government, that the Union is sacred and indissoluble, and anybody who takes a contrary position to that is either unpatriotic, uninformed, or a traitor to the Constitution. So what it, you know, Americans just have to, I guess, one way to do it is to say, okay, let's assume we're starting over. The year's 2014. America doesn't have the history that it has. It doesn't have the war between the states. It doesn't have the New Deal. It doesn't have all the developments that resulted in centralization and the sort of the draining of state sovereignty into the central government. How would we structure a central government today in a country of 315 million people? Would we agree as a people, as states, to join a union which is indissoluble, regardless of the conditions of 2014, but even 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the road? Would anyone in their right mind say that once we're in, we are in it for good, from hell or, you know, whatever might happen? No reasonable, rational person would take that point of view, because you don't know what the future holds. And you would always want to reserve the option to reassert government of, by, and for the people within the respective state. So if that's the position today, and in 1787, of course, founders and the framers were very enlightened about the nature of government and the trajectory of the growth of government. Does anyone think if they would agree to join a union that was indissoluble, that a state, if it was in the interest of the people within that state, would not have the option to withdraw? You know, of course not. That was just, you know, that's why it's not in the Constitution, because it was a given. It didn't need to be in the Constitution. It was understood. Now, that doesn't mean some people didn't want this union to last a very long time. But, of course, nobody in their right mind, especially in these states where the anti-federalists were dominant, would agree to join a union that would that was for life, that could never be dissolved. And that's what Americans have to realize. Forget all the indoctrination, forget about the government schools and what they've been taught, forget about the media and how bad and unpatriotic secession is. Secession is simply a word that means to withdraw from the union in this case. And any rational, reasonable person would say, yes, if things got to the point where being in an association of states under the control of a dominant national central government that's no longer accountable to the people within the states, of course we reserve the right to withdraw and to strike out on our own. So I think that might be a good starting point to you know, start the conversation. What would we do if we were to start to reformulate the nature of the union today? And we would do precisely what they did in 1787. Form a union, hope it would last, things got out of hand, the states, the sovereign units within that association, reserved the right to withdraw. And, but like I said, it's going to be very difficult to break that through the government schools, the media, every other firewall that's been put up in front of the American people to even consider that as an option.
Yeah, it's so funny, because when you describe the argument and you make these common sense observations that when you have a country of 315 million people, well, there's a chance that it might be dysfunctional if it's being ruled infallibly by one city. Like, there's a chance that that might not be the best way for everybody to live. Well, yeah, that suddenly people would scratch their heads and say, you know what, I never thought about that. The reason you never thought about that is, in effect, you are programmed never to think about that. That what exists now is the best arrangement that could possibly exist, and why only a crank would disagree, citizen. I mean, it's almost like, on a much, much smaller scale, how they treated dissidents in the Soviet Union. If you are disagreeing with the workers' paradise, then obviously you have a psychological disorder. It can't be that you have an honorable disagreement with the ruling elite. You have a psychological disorder, and you need to be incarcerated for special treatment. Now, on this general subject, I had Kevin Gutzman on some time ago. I've had him on a couple times on this program. And the first time I had him on, those of you listening can who listen regularly, you can go back in the archive and look at the episode called States' Rights and the Founding. And Kevin shared with us his expertise on Virginia and the Virginia Ratifying Convention. And the language there is quite clear. There's no getting around it that they had in mind the prospect of withdrawing from the Union if it came to that. Now, having said that, can you describe for people the difference between what we might call, what has been called, the compact theory of the Union and the nationalist theory of the Union, and then explain what this distinction might bring to the table in understanding the legitimacy of secession?
I'm going to just mention briefly the Confederate Constitution, because by 1860-61, they understood that there was something wrong with the nature of the compact between the states, and that it was being transitioned into a national democracy as opposed to a confederation of states. And so what they did in their preamble, they made it quite clear that it's not only a compact between the states, i.e. within the Confederate Constitution, but it's a covenant between the states and the Creator. And this covenant theory of the compact theory of the Confederate Constitution was designed to say that if the parties to the agreement breach or don't live up to the agreement, there was a higher power to which they could appeal. And we see this in the Declaration of Independence and other documents. So the compact theory is that there's no superior force holding together the Union, or in this case, the Confederacy, but the goodwill and the good intention of the parties. Now, based upon the Lincolnian model, that's no longer the case. So rather than not having a superior judge that's going to decide that the Union's indissoluble, perpetual, and never to be torn asunder, the national government becomes not only a party to the dispute as to whether or not the agreement has been breached, but also the enforcer as to keeping the Union together. So whereas the Confederate Constitution, reflecting what was the intentions of the, especially the anti-federalists, of the U.S. Constitution, that it was just among the parties of the Constitution that if things didn't work out, they were free to decide on their own to go their separate ways. Under the nationalistic interpretation of the Constitution, the U.S. government will be the decider. And because it's not in their interest to let the Union be dissolved, of course you end up with the indissoluble, perpetual, more perfect Union in which more and more power is centralized. And as was said during the antebellum period, instead of the Constitution being a rope of sand, which just held together by very consent of the members, it becomes shackles of steel controlled by the national government. And that's where you slip into tyranny and the usurpation of the prerogatives of the states to the national government. So you have these two models. I guess you could say the Jeffersonian and the Lincolnian. The Lincoln one is, and I don't know if Lincoln actually understood what he was putting into motion here. He was simply a politician that was representing the interests, the corporate interests of his day, that it was in their political and economic and to a significant extent cultural interest to subjugate the South. But what he actually did is he created this, you know, this Leviathan, this behemoth, this sort of monster that is not, it has this insatiable appetite for more and more power. Whereas the compact theory is that when those tendencies begin to manifest themselves, and the central government becomes tyrannical and or oppressive, then the states can go their separate ways. So the two models of government, the compact theory, it's a loose confederation of states based upon the goodwill of the member states with a higher power looking over to make sure that they comply with the agreement. But if not, the states are their own judges as to whether or not it's in their long-term interest to be associated with the other state. And but we live in a country now that it's a joke to call it a federative republic or a democratic republic. It's a unitary system of government in which all power is increasingly centralized into the national government. And all the organs of that government, seen and unseen, are going to make sure that this union not only stays intact, but also expands. Maybe not based upon what we consider the typical nation state, but it's morphing into this, I won't even say international, because that's no longer used in the literature. It's a transnational model of government. The power is being centralized, and we don't know who has it, how it's exercised, how to keep them accountable. And, of course, the framers would never live under a system like that. How should I put this? There are so many questions that we don't have answers to, and the fact that we don't have answers to the question, who has what power and who's exercising it at what time, to what purpose, is enough evidence in my mind that there's something that has gone substantially wrong with our political order. And we need to, this is where the secession comes in, we need to call back that power. That's what secession is. It's calling back the power, the limited delegated powers we gave to the national government that has been taken and abused by that national government, and to reassert it and reorganize it within the state. So the compact theory allows for that. The nationalistic theory of government does not. And how we get that into the American people's minds, especially the state legislatures, that their best intentions are going to go for naught because we still consider ourselves to be subordinate to the decision makers in Washington. So, for example, you know, I really admire the Tenth Amendment Center, nullification, interposition, and all the different attempts to try to push back against national power. But when all is said and done, they have the organs of government that are going to eventually diffuse all those efforts. And whether it's interposition or nullification, it's going to end up on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's going to make the decision, even if we have victories here, occasional victories on Tenth Amendment grounds. The trajectory of where this country is heading is not favorable to any type of Tenth Amendment powers of the state. So if you look at 2014 and fast forward to 2064, 50 years into the future, based upon how things have operated in the past, incrementally, slowly, but surely, power is being centralized. And I see the United States government today, Tom, to be quite frank, in the position of South Carolina in 1860. We talk about states' rights, but we should be talking about national rights to a certain extent. Because now we're under the umbrella of these transnational governing bodies that nationalism is becoming old-fashioned. So, to put it bluntly, we're in a heap of trouble. And I think this generation today is the remnant. There's enough of a remnant that perhaps in certain pockets of America, there's enough political will and political information and knowledge to have some really significant pushback to the point where we can't necessarily save the whole country, but we might be able to save certain portions or regions of it. But I've been studying American political development for the last 25 years. And if you look where we started, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed, I am not optimistic. Not at all. And so we have these rear guard actions. You know, let's try to get some conservatives on the Supreme Court. Let's try to get more Republicans to the Congress. Let's try to get a Republican in the White House. Let's get the states to, you know, reassert their 10th Amendment prerogatives, so on and so forth. That's fine and dandy. It buys time. The overall shift, the paradigm shift, as slow and incremental as it is towards something that the framers would not recognize. And I don't even know how to define it or what it's going to look like, but it certainly isn't going to look anything like America did in the last 50 years. That's why, you know, the S word, the secession, the withdrawal, to reassert states' rights, prerogatives, I think that's the only option. And there are some positive signs, you know, states breaking up here and there, forming other states, 51st, 52nd, 53rd state, that's fine. But they're still going to be under control of this centralized authority. So the only way to save the principles of the Declaration of Independence and government based upon the consent of the government properly understood is to carve off those parts of the United States that are still salvageable. Some parts of the United States are too far gone, but there are parts within the Union that if they do wake up and see the urgency of acting now, they might be able to save parts of the country. When I say save parts of the country, I'm not talking about, you know, just to remake the United States, but on a state level. I'm talking about, you know, the profound questions of what makes our government unique or our system of government. And that goes back to the foundations, which would be our Judeo-Christian tradition. Because as we see the politics shifting, we also see the theological dynamics of the United States shifting. And, you know, I think we're at a crisis point right now. But because it's such an incremental process, you know, people think, once again, like more Republicans, which I actually think is laughable, work within the system. That's also laughable. It needs to take some real radical, drastic measures to save what we think is worth saving. And that is, to be quite frank, the Judeo-Christian basis of our civilization.
Marshall, before I wrap up, I mean, I sort of figured we would just talk entirely about this sort of topic. But as you were talking, I remembered that I've read a lot of your stuff, but my favorite thing that you've written is an essay in a book about Mel Bradford. And it was an essay in which you were basically explaining the Bradford-Jaffa debate as a debate between a nomocratic political order and a teleocratic political order. And this is a topic that is so important. Of course, we could have a whole program on it. But I wonder, would you mind taking a few minutes to explain to people what that debate between Bradford and Jaffa in Modern Age, I think it was really all about? Because this is a legacy of Lincoln that most people don't realize. Most people think about the legacy of centralized government or secession as being unthinkable in the minds of Americans after Lincoln. But this is equally important, is searing into the American consciousness the idea that they live in a teleocratic political order. Can you sort that out?
Let me try. By a nomocratic political order, your listener should think about process. The process of being a self-governing individual within a democratic, republican political framework. So nomocratic means that there are other things more important than government, and that would be societies such as churches, temples, civic organizations, neighborhoods, traditions. And those percolate up through the political process, and that's the nomadic political order allows the people to participate in government, properly understood, i.e. limited government, and having the government truly based upon their consent. Whereas the teleocratic is the government, I suppose you could, based upon
governed by philosopher kings. At least that's what they consider themselves to be. So Lincoln, and I don't even know if Lincoln would recognize himself in some of the Jaffa literature and the Staunton's generally, but they have this notion that the founding document is not the Constitution, which is democratic, but the Declaration of Independence. And the way they interpret the Declaration of Independence is to be committed to this sort of Lincolnian idea of equality, and they don't even understand, or at least they don't disclose that they understand, what Lincoln meant by equality. But their notion of equality is that America is committed to a proposition. And to cut to the chase, it would be government based upon democratic processes and equality. Now, what they mean by that, if you really, you know, your listeners want to really look into it, is that you have all the motions and distractions of a democracy, or, quote, a democracy, the political processes. But behind the curtain, behind the scenes, you have the cognitive elite manipulating the people, and they manipulate the people by centralizing political power, taking over the institutions, and the people think they're self-governing, but they have been groomed into buying into this concept that the end game is democracy and, quote, equality, which is, we probably don't have time to go into that, but is nonsense. So you can't have a democracy of 315 million people. So by default, the elite, quote, the cognitive elite, the ruling class, takes over. People who consider themselves to be conservatives need to start thinking of themselves as reactionaries. Reactionaries that the status quo is not worth conserving. We need to go back to first principles. And the first principles of the Declaration of Independence properly understood, the U.S. Constitution properly understood, in which the states were sovereign, and I mean that, you know, solving to the point where if they decide they don't want to be in the association of the union with other states, they have the option of leaving. So, you know, I mean, there's so much going on, Tom, and the fact that the American people, Ramsey pointed this out, that if you want to take over America and shift it to the left or centralize power, take over the educational system, that's what they've done. And that's why what you are doing is so important, because you're reawakening the truth and making it accessible and available to people that are hungry for the truth. But that's, you know, the difference between the non-democratic and the democratic, very important distinction. One process, one on principles, based upon what the elite, the ruling class, think those principles should be.
Right. So and, let me give my take on it and how I've sort of understood it, that in the nomocratic order, the idea is that you have self-government, but nobody's telling you what you ought to do, what your ultimate values ought to be. You live your life and you pursue your own goals, and there's no overarching ideological framework within which you're expected to operate. You're just self-governing, and that's it. The process of self-government is what matters. In the teleocratic order, they say, yeah, you have self-government, but everything you do has to be aimed at some higher principle like equality. Now, that sounds harmless enough because in some interpretations, everybody favors some type of equality. But the problem with a floating abstraction like equality is you can't nail down the meaning of it. So for Lincoln, equality may have meant we free the slaves as a war measure. Maybe that's what he meant by equality. But what Hillary Clinton means by equality is something very different. And what people 50 years after Hillary Clinton will mean by equality will make Hillary Clinton look like Edmund Burke. And so the idea is that this is an idea that can't ever be contained. You will always be in a state of permanent revolution that will require the expansion of government, because since equality is a fantasy in most renditions of it, the only way it can be enforced is by increasing the power of government. So teleocratic regimes tend to increase over time because they're always telling us a teleocratic regime is one that says that this country is dedicated to a principle. What, does that ring any bells? That's the idea of Lincoln and everybody who's followed him on the left and the right, they love this idea of the teleocratic political order because it means you don't leave people alone to govern themselves as they see fit. It means you second-guess everything they do and you try to mold them according to some abstract principle that admits of no ultimate conclusion. It is always going to be making more and more and more demands on you. The gods of equality are jealous gods, and they don't ever go away. So that's my sort of overall take on it. Well, Marshall, what are you up to these days? Are you working on any scholarly projects these days?
Yeah, I am. But during the early stages, I'm taking a break, sort of, from the writing book. I'm working on a law review article regarding the state of West Virginia, how it became a state during the war. It's really interesting because of the politics involved in it. And using that, perhaps other states that want to break off or partition, could use that as a sort of a game plan on how they might want to consider. Because not only were the states involved, Virginia and what came to be West Virginia, but the Congress, the Senate, the courts, the executive branch. So the dynamics are pretty interesting. But other than that, you know, just teaching courses, keeping body and soul together, four kids, wife, you know, trying to keep my head above water financially. That's about like most other people out there, just trying to survive.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Well, Marshall, I appreciate your time today. Very interesting and provocative stuff, as always. And best of luck with all those things.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Real good touching base with you again. We'll have to do it more often.
Thanks again, Marshall. Okay, guys, a couple quick things before we wrap up. Every time I host the Peter Schiff Show, I offer 50% off at my libertyclassroom.com. And I know it sounds like I'm just making this up, but I'm not sure I'm going to be doing that anymore. I have other ways that I want to use to promote that site. But today is one of those days. So if you happen to get over to libertyclassroom.com today, you can use coupon code SCHIFF in all caps and get 50% off. It's 9 courses, soon to be 10. So when you join, you get all of them. It's not like you get one or two or a la carte. You get everything. When you join, you can listen to them or watch them at your convenience, and you got our Q&A forums for a year. It's super great. You'll really love it. So grab that great opportunity. That window of opportunity is closing rapidly. Also, remember my events coming up. University of Central Arkansas this Saturday, then April 9th, Florida Southern College, April 10th, Liberty University, and May 9th in Provo, Utah. You will make me really, really happy if you subscribed to the program on iTunes. Or if you don't like iTunes, subscribe on some other program. But you would really make me happy. And plus, you'd make yourself happy. What an archive you'd have of wonderful programming. Also, help me spread the word about this program. If you got a blog, post about the show. Link people to iTunes. Let's get the word out about this baby. All right, everybody, what's left of me will be right here at the usual time tomorrow. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.